Welcome to the Sendcast. My name is Dale Pickles. I'm the Managing Director of B Squared and the host of the Sendcast, the podcast for special educational needs and disability. Each week on the podcast, we talk about a different topic within the world of SEND to improve our knowledge, to provide support to professionals working in schools, to empower parents and to raise awareness. In this episode, we discussed wellbeing, culture and inclusion. And my guest this week was Cassel Lynch, Director for Wellbeing Quality Mark. Cassel has extensive leadership experience in mainstream and special education, including as a National Director of SEND and a MAT co-founder. He is also an Associate Education Expert for The Key. The Sendcast is created by us here at B Squared. Do you know about the AI features within our assessment software? Teachers can use our AI to help write their reports or to summarise progress. Teachers choose those key achievements and the key next step, so it's very, very personalised. But the AI takes the hard work away, turning what you want to focus on and creating the paragraphs of text for you. And the system can also translate into 40 different languages, helping to engage parents where English is not their first language. Visit the B Squared website or click on the meeting link in the show notes to book a meeting with me to take you through our assessment software and its AI features. Now, let's get on with the podcast. My guest on this week's episode is Cassel Lynch, a director from Wellbeing Quality Mark. Cassel has extensive leadership experience in both mainstream and special education, including as a national director of a group of schools, and he's also been a MAT co-founder. He has also been, or he also is, an associate education expert for The Key, and Cassel is a coach, assessor, and facilitator on the NPQEL course and helps schools embed an inclusive approach to wellbeing and quality first teaching. So Cassel obviously has lots of time on his hands. Welcome to the show, Cassel.
Thank you, Dale. Nice to be here.
You're welcome. It's always what does Dale do? I'm director of B Squared and I host a podcast. And there's other people like, yeah, I can just list, be here for half an hour just on the intro.
It sounds more impressive than it is, believe you me.
Okay, so wellbeing, culture and inclusion are three really big buzzwords being used a lot at the moment in lots of places, but they aren't simply buzzwords. They are things you'll stick on somewhere to make it look good, but they are extremely important. And it's not about ticking those boxes or doing a whole school training session and giving ourselves on the pat of the back that we've looked at our culture, wellbeing and inclusion. It's about making real change within schools to improve the culture for all, improve everyone's wellbeing and to be inclusive.
Absolutely. I think the important thing with all of these things is a culture refers to the way we do things. And actually, I always talk about cultures that need to be curated, because it's a bit like doing a museum exhibition. You need to continually look at how it's going to be presented in its best light. So when you're working on culture, it's very much a piece of work that's never done. You're always refining it. You're always working on it. And essentially what we're trying to do is create routines that can become habitual, because when they become habits, it reduces cognitive load. We don't have to think about it, and it's good for the pupils and it's good for the staff. The difficulty we have is that very often schools don't pay close enough detail to defining the way that they do things and the way that it needs to look like. And I talk sometimes about the fact that we need to make it difficult for difficult people to be difficult. The way I prefer to frame that is by saying, actually, we need to make it easy for good people to get better. And by good people, I mean those who are ethically and morally aligned to the vision and values that we share. And we can only share vision and values if they've been co-constructed with our stakeholders. So with the Wellbeing Quality Mark, a big part of what we do is we elicit the views of our staff, the views of our pupils, and the views of our parents. I go into schools a lot, and when I ask the pupils their views about things, they generally speaking say, well, everybody always asks us what we think, but nobody ever tells us anything that happens with it. You know, we never get any feedback. And that's the thing that will destroy a culture quicker than anything else. If you're not feeding back and closing that feedback loop, then you're putting yourself in a very vulnerable position. And this work stemmed out of some work when I was running a group of special schools. It stemmed out of some work that I did with some EPs, one of whom was doing their doctorate at the time. So I always say that I clung onto his coattails for all I was worth. And then one of the things they did as their orientation exercise was something called a multi-dimensions perspective framework, whereby they did questionnaires with the pupils, the parents and the staff. They did some rich picture exercises. They looked at, there were statements in those days. And I remember thinking as somebody, I was running three schools at the time. We were outstanding in all areas and, you know, we thought we were doing great work. And I remember thinking, well, what, you know, what's every beginner tell us? We're already doing really good work. And that, you know, hubris was an absolute, I look back on that with eternal shame. Because what happens when you ask those questions is not just the answers that you get, which are really, really important, but it does something to you from a cultural perspective. We were dealing with a lot of pupils and parents who'd lived life on the margins. They had been the children who'd failed everywhere they'd been. They'd been thrown out of everywhere they'd been. Attacking the head teacher was usually a good way to get referred to us. You know, the parents had usually not had a very good experience with education or with authority figures generally. So they were always naturally very reticent. And so there was, you know, there was a lot of angst and anxiety. And what we did by asking those questions was something to the culture of the organization. And I only realized a long time afterwards that once we'd finished it, was that by doing that, what we were essentially saying to our pupils and our parents was, you matter. Your views matter. You matter to us. And we want to know what you think. And they were able, because they were looking at things from a different perspective, they were able to give us some insights that we hadn't considered. And although some of them were hard lessons, I realized that the only way we could really, really get better was exactly by doing that. And that fed into our school improvement and the way that we worked going forward from that. And the other thing that I realized is what that did was built a sense of belonging amongst our staff, our pupils and our parents. So a few years ago, I was asked by Andy Book to write a book about my approach to school improvement, which has evolved into the Wellbeing Quality Mark. And that's what I called it, Building Belonging, because it's very much about that sense of bringing people together. And there's plenty of research in plenty is a bit an exaggeration, but there is research in how we go about and do this. Because I'd worked with the EPs, which I was very lucky to, I realised that we had such complex needs that, you know, as an educationist, I needed some help with it because, you know, it's taken me to the edge of my capacity professionally. And through time, we added senior people from the NHS in terms of senior OTs, senior speech and language therapists. So we built a therapeutic model. I went to the launch of a document called the What Works Framework by Professor Catherine Weir, which was a piece of work commissioned by the National Children's Bureau, which is a group of charities that come together to advocate for children's rights. So I went down to London to hear the launch of this, and I was fascinated because Professor Weir presented it all. And as I was sitting there and listening, I thought, this is exactly the model that I've created, but I don't have I'm not a professor, so I couldn't articulate it as well as Professor Weir was able to. But what she did was she outlined six areas. Seven areas, one of them being engaging the whole community. So that's your questionnaires and what have you. But she talked about the fact that we needed to think about adopting whole school approaches. So that very much fed in with the idea that approaches are likely to work when they are whole school more so than when they're piecemeal or when they're, you know, and that speaks to your vision and values. It speaks to your approach to your pedagogical your pedagogy, how you go about the craft and the art of teaching, you know. Then she talked about prioritising professional learning and staff development and creating supportive policies and procedures that reflect what's going on the ground. And she also talked about implementing targeted programme interventions, including for the curriculum, which argued that we needed to explicitly teach PHSE and have it running through the whole curriculum. We needed to be really clear about any interventions we were delivering. We needed to measure starting points and end points. And in so doing, we needed to work out whether they actually were effective or not, or whether it was Mrs. Miggins once did a course 5 years ago and we've got the resources, so we're going to keep doing it, whether it has impact or not, you know. And the crucial bit for me, because I always look in different directions when I'm doing this, because there's a particular diagram that that we use, which has got all of the sections on it, and I visualize them so I can work out what it is. But if they don't work, you know, and one of the EPs used to talk to me about, you know, who's not learning here? If a child's having a phonics intervention in year one and they're still having a phonics intervention in year three, who's not learning? It's not just the child, you know. So actually, there's a danger that there's something else going on there. And that's where we need to look at implementing targeted responses and potentially identifying specialist pathways. So that might be where we go on to you know, either individual or group support for social emotional learning, or a referral to CAMS, speech and language, something else that is more specialist. And so therefore, that early intervention is hard baked into the model. So it's very much about intervening early and getting so that, because we know that if things go unaddressed at an early age, that they can develop into mental health difficulties later in life. Go on, you were going to say.
So a lot to unpick in all of that. And I'm trying to remember the key points in my head. So the first one is you talked about culture, and you kind of talk about as you're curating, and people kind of don't think about that culture. The problem is with culture is it's always there. The problem is, are you creating it or are you not? And if you use your museum analogy, is that door is going to open at 9 a.m., whether you've curated something or not. If you're partway through and not organized, that's your culture. If you haven't even thought about it and there's just nothing there at all, that's your culture. If you're prepared and you've set it all out perfectly and you're really engaging and inviting, that's your culture. If you've set it all up and left it alone because it's there and it's obvious, that's your culture. And whether you like it or not, the moment you start as a head teacher, and this is, I think, when schools can change, if you don't have that really good whole school built-in practice that kind of that new head teacher can kind of fit into and things are happening, if it's kind of stop and start from one head teacher to the next, that's a complete culture change. And that's where I think lots of things change, where we have those culture changes is it there's a lack of information? Is it the processes aren't written down? Is it it's one person doing things? But the culture is always there, but it is whether or not you realize it's there and how much of an impact you have as a leader. And that culture bit is people assume, well, what is your culture? And people say, we don't have one. It's like, no, you always have a culture. You always have a culture. You can't, but it's this not paying attention to it can be a good thing, because actually what you're doing is great and you're just going for it and everyone's with you. But actually, if you've not paid attention to read the room, you're probably going to get things wrong.
Yeah. Well, the culture will exist whether you put in it proactively, because the young people will create the culture themselves, because nature abhors a vacuum. So something will move in to fill that space. So it's far better that we create a positive culture than allow a negative culture that to come to the fore. And you hit the nail on the head perfectly there. You're talking about whether it's written down and whether it's an individual. So one of the things that we need to do, and one of the things that Wellbeing Quality Mark encourages to do, and just before I move on to this, I was going to say the last area that she talked about was looking upon behaviours as a potential manifestation of unmet need. And if you imagine that on a page, that is a school. It might be a special school. It might be, that middle bit might be your resource base. It could be, you know, but that for me made sense. So what I did with that then was I reverse engineered those six areas and asked the staff questions based on it to discover based on all of the research and some of the learn that and learn how to statements from the MPQs and some of the Ofsted criteria. But actually I asked questions which would allow us to work out which of those six areas we were doing well and which elements of them we may need to consider for improvement purposes. Okay. And that therefore fits in beautifully with the new implementer. Well, it's not new anymore, but the implementation guidance. And with the work I do on the MPQ and the MPQEL even, we cover the new implementation guidance, yet it's still not fully understood in schools. And one of the things it talks about, it's absolutely clear on this, is we need to do fewer things in greater depth. We need to go slower in order to go faster. And schools are really good at getting faster and faster and faster and faster. They're very, very poor at making time and space to stop and think.
And one thing on that, when you were talking about, like, you were outstanding in Ofsted in every area, And you're kind of like, well, what more can I do? I'm perfect. And it's that kind of...
ridiculous. And by the way, I'd never do it again. I've got no interest in that whatsoever.
You learn that through that journey you're on. And then when you're asking, you ask the parents, you ask the students, you ask the teachers, what can we improve? And it is, what are you judging yourself on? And when I think of inclusion, people go, it's hard to define inclusion. To me, it's really simple. It's not what you're doing. It's how you make that person feel. Yeah. And so in Ofsted, having those all there, we're ticking everything we're told to do for inclusion, we're doing, we're great. Then you ask that person, what are you doing? How inclusive are we? And they say, you're not inclusive. You don't just go, well, I'm ignoring you because over here it says we are inclusive. Well, what is it we're not doing? Cool. What out of all these things we do, which of them make you feel inclusive? Included? None of them. Okay. So why are we doing them? Actually asking. Those having that, giving your parents and giving your students that voice and finding out what makes them feel included, that sense of belonging, that's the bit you do. You don't go, give me a checklist to be inclusive. No, no. Ask your students, ask your parents, what would make you feel included? That's the bit we do.
Indeed, indeed, very much so. And part of that with your staff and with any change agenda is looking at those behaviours. And this is very much drawn. So the implementation guidance has got Vivienne Robinson's fingerprints all over it. She wrote a book called Reduce Change to Increase Improvement. And I highly recommend that book, right? Firstly, because it's a really easy read, as is Professor Weir's What Works Framework. So they tick my boxes. They're simple, they're easy to understand and easy to digest. Vivienne Robinson's stuff is so embarrassingly obvious that once you know it, like you almost can't look anybody else in the eyes, really, because you think, God. And she says that, you know, one of the reasons that improvement fails is firstly because schools are always trying to do too many things at once, which, by the way, is a risk factor for poor mental health,
yep.
Because the capacity to reflect is a protective factor against mental health difficulties for pupils and for staff, but we continue yet to go faster and faster and faster and faster. She also says, by the way, that we need to consider not just academic outcomes, but social, emotional, social, cultural and academic outcomes, that all three of them are equally valid because they all feed into each other. And that is a really important bit, I think, that we forget about sometimes, you know. But they talk about the behaviours that we need for implementation is to engage people around what it is that we're implementing and why it matters. And that speaks back to your values as well as speaks back to actually discussing things with your staff and getting them to highlight what we're doing. And then how do we unite them around what we're trying to do? And then how do we build the reflection so we can consider whether things are working or not working and how effectively they're going? There's also contextual factors and the process involved in that. But again, that word engage is lifted straight out of Vivienne Robinson's, where she talks about the fact that most leaders will adopt a bypass approach so that they will have an alternative theory of action, what they want to do. And instead of discussing it with the staff and finding out what their beliefs are, they will just try to implement it. And she says that is the same is true of government initiative, local authority initiatives, and very often now multi-academy trust initiatives. So if we're not involving the stakeholders by checking with that, that's a way to bring everybody on board. So the wellbeing quality mark, it automatically does that by using those surveys now the surveys are very bespoke around pedagogy for the staff, but they're not quite the same. They're more about belonging for the pupils and the parents, you know.
So with that kind of school improvement and all those things there, I always come back to, and everyone generally seems to hate it because of the way it's been implemented, but APDR. Assess, plan, do, review, think about in school improvement. And often when people are thinking of school improvement, they're jumping to the do. We need to jump in and do something. We're going to, this new thing everyone else is doing, we need to jump in. It's the right thing. We're going to do it. We're not actually assessing where you are. And assessing in kind of the school improvement also means getting all the viewpoints. Yeah. If that head teacher is just going, then you've skipped assess.
And that's part of the, so in terms of the process.
You skip the plan. And actually, yeah. You can't just dive in. It's like, right, what is the plan? What is it actually going to look like? You can't just dive in going for it. Actually, have you built a team around that initiative? Actually, have you set things up so it is going to succeed? Is somebody responsible for it? And then you finally get to the actual doing, but you don't just finish there. You've got to review.
Yeah, of course, of course. And that's in terms of the process, that's the explore stage, that bit where you're doing the, like, you're looking at it, then you move to preparing everybody with the training, whatever you deliver, and then you sustain it, which might be, if you're going to scale it up or do anything else, you repeat, you go back to the start of the process. But you've absolutely hit the nail on the head there, because the contextual factors that they also talk about, and I think the new implementation guide is a wonderful document. There's a lot to unpick in it, but it's really, really good. So you've got to consider whether it's evidence-informed, whether it's right for the setting, whether it's feasible to implement, you know, because it might be right for the setting, but it might not be the right time to do it in the setting. Yes. But then you've got to think of whether you've got the infrastructure that support the implementation, whether you've got the systems and structures in place. That might be timetabling, it might be checklists, it might be frameworks, whatever else. But then crucially, and you just talked about, have you got the right people in place? And not only that, have those people got the agency to drive the change, right? And if they don't, then it ain't going to happen, right?
We have schools at B Squared where we'll do the kind of the sales meeting, we'll chat with the leaders and we'll talk about it. And they will say, cool, we're definitely going to do this, but not for 6 months. Because they recognize you can't just bring in a piece of software in it to fix things. You've kind of got to get everyone's knowledge. You've kind of got to change the culture. You've got to get that ethos change, the values. You've got to bring it in. You've got to upskill everyone. You've got to make the priorities. You've got to highlight why we need to do this. And you're going to change all that. And that is kind of, you're kind of seeding it all. You're growing it. And then at the right point, you then go, right, and this is how we're going to do it. And off you go. Whereas if you just bring it in with no context, no preparation, no understanding, no why, no building it in and helping people see that actually maybe the current system isn't working, and it might be that you're asking questions you know somebody cannot answer, that actually they're starting to go, right, yes, we need this. And it's that work of that bringing it in and planning and dripping it in. So then when you do it, it's going to be successful.
And so that's why with the wellbeing work, we include some I normally say that we need to do at least a training session with senior leaders so they understand this. But I also have got an offer where, as a result of requests from schools, I've now got a training course that we've put together, which takes place over a period of time, which has got a combination of talk content, some coaching, but also some activities that the staff need to undertake. So we call it Building Belonging. It's a course for aspiring leaders, really, who are trying to develop those leadership skills. And that the bottom line with all of it is, one of the reasons, to go back to what you were saying earlier on, is one of the things that doesn't happen is that when you said schools don't write things down, no, they don't. And it's really important to codify your practice. I'm really big on codification, right? So, and the reason for that is because once you've codified things and you've done that with your staff, so you've co-created it and you've agreed on the research, everybody's clear on what it is, and this is how we're going to, for example, line up at the door. Really simple one, right? And you can tell if you go around and walk through a school, you know, I went to one recently, and there was a teacher in one of the classes, absolutely brilliant. She had a little routine for it. Children were immaculate. And in another one, they just went, right, line up at the door. And four of the kids ran from the back of the room, pushed everybody out of the way. In a primary school, they wanted to be first, like, you know, it was carnage. Now, if we know about executive function, which we will come on to in a moment, you know, those key transitional times are really, really important, you know. And if you start that, if that's wrong, so actually, we need to codify what that looks like. And actually, to do that, if you've got a really good example already happening in your school, codify what's going on there, because it works. There's your evidence base. It's already working with the sorts of children you're working with. You know, it doesn't happen so much now, but I used to hear a lot where, you know, oh, we took this from an outstanding school. Well, that's a complete waste of time. You need to take things from a similar schools and make sure it's effective, because it's what works for you here and now. How are you going to work it out? What's the evidence base that you've drawn it from? You know, and that codification helps prevent professional slippage. And that's what I meant by make it difficult for difficult people to be difficult, because some people like shades of grey. They like ambiguity, because therein lies a lack of accountability, right? And once we start defining in detail how we should be doing things, right? It makes it really easy to spot that performance gap. That's where we should be doing it, and somebody's performing there. That gap is readily apparent, but we're not using it to beat people. We're using it to help them to get better by having the research, having a one page with a checklist on it. Have you done this? And that can form the basis of an instructional coaching program then, because this is what we're going to look at.
So with that, and again, the lining up is a really great example, because on one hand, you are doing it as an example of a consistent approach. That's what we kind of used. But it's not just about your staff. It's about the children. What are their expectations? And if it is a case of you have, let's say you're a 2-4 entry school when you mix the classes up each year or whatever, and you have one child who's come from that really ordered teacher.
Absolutely.
And one child who's come from the you just push to the front, and they get put in the same class, and that first child was near the door, so they stood at the front and gets pushed out the way. Their expectation is this is not how this works. They may then going, this is not right. And that, it's that consistent expectation. In the neurodivergent world, we always talk about the idea of certainty, that comfort. I know what to expect. So when I go from one class to the next, I'm going to line up the same. It's going to be the same rules. What I write on the top of my page with the
date.
It's going
to be written in the same place.
Same place. I'm not going to write it as I've done for the last year and then get told, I don't write it there. I don't like it there. Why? And basically, when you have those weird things, it really tells you it doesn't matter. Yeah. If teacher A likes the date on the right and teacher B writes the date on the left, what you're really saying is it doesn't matter. You're just being in charge. But if you're having that consistent approach that they can go from one year to the next and it is seamless, that things like writing the date is the same, what you need, how you line up, all those things are consistent, then those child expectations are, ah, I'm going to drift in and I'm going to continue. And there's no load on me in adjusting to my new class.
So I talk a lot about the need for structure, routine and consistency. Okay. Because if we understand about executive functioning, the brain develops from the bottom up, and the bottom part is responsible for, you know, survival, if you will. The part above that is responsible for a group of skills known as executive function. And it orders lots and lots of different things, but it's dependent on the strong development of the bottom part in order for that to remain healthy and remain strong. And when that happens in the right way, when it doesn't happen in the right way, which might mean because children are growing up in deprivation, which isn't to say that deprivation alone will cause that, but where there's chaos and disorder in that deprivation, okay, that can interrupt where children are flooded with toxic stress, the stress can become toxic, all of those sorts of things, right? But also it's common amongst neurodivergent children to struggle with executive function. Now, executive function helps, it supports working memory. So actually, if you've got weak executive function, your working memory is impaired. Your ability to remember things and to process things is limited. So therefore, you need things broken down into really small chunks to make sure that you don't become overwhelmed. It also is responsible for changing gear from moving from one activity to another. And that might be, so in schools, everybody talks about transition as being between key stages. Key stage two and key stage three is the, primary and secondary is the big one, right? But in reality, transition could be stopping one task and starting another. It might be moving from the mat to move to a chair. It could be like, it could be really, really small things like that, you know. And the other thing weak executive function leads to is impulsivity. Now, if you think of children who struggle in schools, pretty much all of them will struggle with one of those areas. And how do we counteract that? We counteract that through making school, by creating structure, routine and consistency. Because when we do that, we make school predictable. And when what goes on is predictable, it reduces cognitive load, thereby curtailing anxiety. And it allows staff to reframe attention seeking as attachment seeking behaviors, right? And the sum, the end result of all of that is greater than the sum of its parts, because it will lead to greater learning outcomes, better behavior outcomes, because fundamentally the anxious brain is not a learning brain. So the more we can avoid the anxiety, right, then the better we're going to get on. The learning's going to be better. The behavior's going to be better. and that sense of belonging is going to be stronger. So all of this is built into the wellbeing quality mark, which is why I say there needs to be some accompanying training to go with it, because this is not a one-off hit.
No.
This is a way of being, a way of thinking. It's a way of shifting your emphasis a little bit to becoming a lot more evidence and research informed, but actually drawing on things from different domains. And I've been very, very lucky. I'm not, you know, in as much as I've worked for people, where, you know, EPs, but also people from the health service, so the health sector. Lots of these things around, if we had time, we'd go on to sensory processing as well, but we haven't, those things. Why would educationalists know about that? It's something not from an educational domain, it's from a health domain. But unfortunately, the children that I was working with 20 years ago, who were in independent special schools, are now all in mainstream schools. So now we need to know about this, and we don't.
But there are things like thinking about those transitions, and a really obvious one. So it's, again, when you're creating these, your timetables, your daily, kind of what your day looks like, don't just write it down on your own. So again, going back to that leadership, don't just do my own assessment and bring my own beliefs in. Actually, you need to include the kind of what the situation is. There's no point in coming straight in after lunch to silent reading. You are going to have so many behavior issues. It's so obvious. We all know this, but why? And it's this executive function, that ability to go from that bouncing around, playing football, to being silent. That won't work. Just because you want it to, it isn't going to work. You can't change it. If they're struggling with that executive function, that ability to transition, you need an intermediate. You need come in, we'll do this first, bringing them down. You need a structure. But it's not a case of I will dictate. It's what will work best for us. And generally, you'll learn over time, actually, yeah, we can't just go from high down to low. We need that middle activity. We need something in the classroom where there is still something, but there's structure around it. So you can't just shout out, but it isn't just sitting there. And you're bringing them down. And that's what it's about. Same way as you're doing this, it's not just dictating. It's using all that information that is available to you, finding out from the children, listening to them. Now, sometimes listening is them misbehaving every Tuesday. Behavior is communication. Behavior is unmet need. That is a communication that you need to learn to listen to and go, what could I change? That's the thing. When we talk about leadership culture, it's not my way or the highway. Generally, we want the best outcomes for everyone. And sometimes you need to be flexible to get the best outcome.
Absolutely.
And so, it's working out. Listen, again, it's not always going to be that child giving you a nice, really eloquent, this is what I need and why. They might not know. Some people are learning about executive function for the first time in 2026.
Yeah.
You've got a class full of children struggling with executive function. You have never heard of the term executive function. How are they going to convey that? And it's probably through a dysregulation.
Of course it is. Of course it is. And it won't be consciously.
No.
It will be subconsciously. However, you know, I remember doing some work in a school, and it's a few years ago now, and one of the things that happened, the bells were inside the classroom, and they were really, really loud. And I went in and did an observation in the morning, and there was something like 16 transitions that morning. An early years setting, and it was either moving from the mat to the table, to here, to there, to there. And one of the things we did, the leaders took a very brave move. They agreed that they'd turn the bells off, because I could see some of these children were like visibly tensing because they knew this thunderous noise was coming. And some of them won't have any diagnosis of a sensory nick, but it was something that was intolerable to them. So their anxiety straight away was really high. And then we were putting loads of transitions on top of them. And of course, we were concerned that, you know, staff might miss forget things. Oh, the kids were on the timings, no bother. They knew what was going on. There was no danger of overrunning. But of course, behaviours improved massively because we were just being mindful of what. But if you don't know about that because you're an educationist, you're not a healthcare professional, then you're going to look at it and think, you know. And that's one of the things. The narrative, we went down a dark path for a long time, and there's still lots of places that still do it. Whereby if somebody arrived at secondary school without the right equipment, then it was a detention, right? Very, very often.
We're still there. We're still there in lots of places, haven't we?
Well, yeah, yeah. But those are the children with weak executive function.
Yes.
Now, if they've forgotten their hearing, like, you know, their hearing device, you're not going to say, well, you're in detention, you haven't got your equipment. If they've got a ruler and a pencil, you know, straight away, you know, they can, you know, and thankfully a lot of the leaders I work with now are very pragmatic. So, well, we give them to them, like, you know, and they hand them back it, like, you know, we give them to for a debt, like, you know, yeah, why are we making problems where they don't, by this draconian thing, you will do this and you will subjugate to our, you know, subjugate yourself to our will, because it doesn't work. And that isn't how you create that sense of belonging and that sense of shared, and it very much that comes from shared experiences, you know, and, you know, so all these things like sports teams, responsibilities in schools, they're all really, really, really important. But as are the activities that you might be doing at playtimes and lunchtimes, you know, and very often, you hear, oh, they can't cope with doing. Well, don't leave them in unstructured. Don't leave them in times of unstructured play. Make sure that for some children, you've got something that's a lot more highly structured, because they'll be able to cope with it, you know.
So one bugbear, executive function, kind of your timetable, remembering things, remembering your homework, things like that. So many schools now have got these lovely apps. Yeah. Detentions are put in Class Charts or Arbor or Sims or whatever. And your homework is in Google Classroom. And this is in this app. And your kids end up with like four apps. And they're not allowed to have their phone out in school. So you have to know before you arrive at school, you have a detention at the end of school, and you have to remember that, and that you have to all day to know that you go to that detention. What happens if you forget that detention? You're going to repeat the cycle of getting another detention.
I would have been the kid that forgot the detention.
I always did.
Because every time I talk about executive function, I think, yeah, mine's not the best here.
And then you might get like a head teacher detention because you're just not turning up. But the problem is you've banned a phone, but that is also how you're telling your kids to be organised. And it's one of the things with the whole call banning phones. It's like, that's cool. I get the reasons why. I personally, it's social media that's the problem, not the phones themselves. It's how we use them. But you then have to have a different way of organising. Yeah, you then need to go back to basically paper diaries in secondary schools. Yeah, if you're going to say no phones, how does a child know? Have you done it? What's the homework? I don't know. I can't look at my phone to know if I've done it or not. I can't remember. I can't actually get my phone. And it's just this thing. I think when you have these new agendas and you've got these new, oh, we're going to do this. Don't just, again, going back to what we talked about earlier, the assessing, what is the impact on our staff? What's the impact on the children? Having a loud bell in the classroom, cool, it keeps everyone on time. What's the negative side? Children are anxious. Yeah. Children are going, oh my God, it's 10 o'clock. It's going to go any minute. If we get rid of the bell, what's the outcome? What's the issue? This will happen. Will it? Test it. Oh, it didn't happen.
Absolutely. Cool. Let's test it.
But don't just say, well, we need it. Don't be that authoritarian. Yeah. It is very much. And again, social media is very much for parents versus schools, teachers versus leaders, schools versus Ofsted. It's social media and all the media breeds on somebody not liking someone and blaming. But in reality, a school, and we think about community, we think about belonging, we think about inclusion, we think about well-being, we're thinking about that culture. Teachers, senior leaders, parents, and children need to be working together to create a school for the community. And you can't just say, or because, or we say so, or go for those small control pins to give you power. And actually, what do the children want? What do the parents want? What do teachers spend their whole time doing which isn't actually making a difference? They're the questions you're going to ask.
And also, by the way, I need to just say, we're not saying that the pupils or the parents or the staff are right.
No.
What I'm saying is that they may as well be right, because that's their reality. And if we don't know what they're thinking, we can't address that misconception. So very often when we do this work, there's always low hanging fruit that is that we can rectify with either a word, a paragraph in a newsletter, or in an assembly. So, well, do you remember what people seem to think that the rules are this and this, but let me remind you that it's this and that. And all of a sudden, you've got a really easy win. It might be something you say, well, we acknowledge that we need to do that. At the moment, that's not our priority, but thank you very much for letting us know, because it is something we want to work on. Because if you're working on any more than one or two things in any academic year, and why would you think about school improvement over 1 year, by the way? Like, you should be thinking about it over 3 to 5 years. And the way I view this is that it's a bit like having an abacus, and at the far end on the right of the abacus, you've just got clumps of wood. And as you move further towards the left, they're a little bit more, they're a little bit more refined and a little bit. So by the time you actually come to move one over, they're usually reasonably well sorted. They're going to look reasonably spherical, but we still don't know. We're still working on them, right? And some of the rough home bits of wood may never make it across the abacus because other things might come in. But actually, that's what school improvement is. We're doing things, and I think back again with shame when. When I was a literacy leader in school, like 1 week I'd have a staff meeting. The next week the science lead would have it. The maths lead would have it. Weekend. And we do what we want everybody to do. Like, that would be, that's how we're going to be doing this bit of literacy or that bit of maths or that bit of science or that bit of whatever it might be. PE. We're going to, And then you would never visit it again. We go, well, we've told them. That's fine. Get on with it. Right?
Yeah.
And if you think about those Rosenschild's principles of instruction, apply them to your blooming to how the staff need to learn. You've got to revisit it. You've got to you've got to model it. You've got to scaffold it. So a lot of what we advocate is that actually, if you need to get the children to, if you need to practice with staff what lining up or checking for understanding or whiteboards or whatever it might be, like role play it first. And then, with staff, so it's comfortable. So the first time you're doing it, you build muscle memory. So the first time you're doing it, isn't it when you've got a class of children in front of you? Then you'll practice it with the children so they understand what you're going to ask of them. So everybody is really clear. Now, what that will do is it will make everything go much, much slower, but it will make it run much, much deeper. And it's that idea of an inch wide but a mile deep. And then once you sort of codify what that's going to look like, everybody's been through the process. And incidentally, what that does is means that you've got really robust induction for new members coming in. But also, if the leader leaves, because we're working to a framework, because the following year you can repeat the surveys and you can demonstrate how far you've moved, right? And so if Ofsted or anybody else comes in, says, well, how do you know? Well, our pupils tell us this, our parents tell us this, this is the stakeholders' views. And you can see that they've moved on since we did it. And it doesn't really matter that, you're not comparing, we're just comparing the overarching views to see where we get. And it's based on that concept of a rising tide lifts all boats. What falls to the bottom 1 year shouldn't be, because it's been attended to. And it might slip a little bit, but we've got it codified. And the amount of times I've been in a school and something will happen or something will go awry and people are like, what was that thing we used to do? Do you remember it was really effective? And it's gone because either the institutional memory's gone of the people who did it or whatever else. If it's codified and it's there, you've got something to go, you've got something there. And we're not talking about the same, it's not the same as a staff handbook. This is, and we used to talk about, non-negotiables. Now, for me, a non-negotiable means that I'm stood in front of you waving my finger saying, oh, thou shall not, right? Well, that's no good either. That's not building a sense of belonging. That's actually building a sense of fear and antagonism, basically, and divisiveness, right? So it's about doing it together, bringing things together. And therein is the way that we make people feel that they're involved in the process and the journey, especially if they're really clear on why we're doing it. So if you've got clarity on that, it's like, because what we want to be able to do is spot our cultural outliers, right? Because you will always have cultural outliers. The problem with cultural outliers is they'll very often give lip service to supporting what you're trying to do, but actually, behind the scenes, they're not, and they might be chuntering and all the rest of it, right? I want to know who my cultural outliers are. right? Because, you know, if you're not with me, you're against me. And if as a community, we've agreed we're going to work like this, it becomes a lot easier to have those challenging conversations with staff or with parents and with pupils. Say, well, actually, we've all agreed. And I did this in a school once. They had a resource base for a county resource base, and they had a really, and they were at their wit's end. It was the governors who came to me, actually. They were at their wit's end and said, look, we've got a really hardcore group of parents here. They just, all the time, they're complaining to us, they're complaining everywhere. And it's always about children in the it was a local authority base, right? So it was serving the whole of the region, and they just didn't want it, you know. And I looked at all of their values and I said, but you haven't really got anything about inclusion and diversity here. So it probably would be a good idea to include that, because the conversation then becomes about the fact that as a community, we've agreed that this is how we're going to work. You don't seem to think that that's going to be appropriate for your child. So maybe you want to consider whether this really is the right place for your child to continue their education. That is not the same as saying, if you don't like it, you know what you can do. It's a subtle difference, but well, it's not a subtle difference at all. It's not a subtle, I don't even know why I said that, right? But the point is, right? Everybody else, there might be a little coterie of you might be 5 or 6 strong. We're 286 strong, right? And this is the way that we're working because we've agreed it. So does that make sense?
It does make sense. It's the sort of thing which is kind of, you mentioned about being involved and whether or not, so. And there is a really big difference about being involved and feeling you're being involved. So if you're a head teacher who kind of has that ear to the ground and hears everything and makes all your decisions based on that, in reality, everyone is involved in that decision. So you're literally going, no one likes this, blah, 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 I'm going to make that change. Yeah? That can have a positive impact. But if you don't let them know that you heard.
Yeah.
That they said this. So sometimes it is a case of before you implement it, you slow down a bit and going, right, so I've been thinking of some changes. I want to get all of your input. I've heard some people don't like this, so I want to do this. What do you lot think? Because I really value your opinion. And actually having that conversation, maybe not as bluntly or that, but actually going, I need your input. And I've heard this from people. I just want to clarify. You're now basically saying is, I'm not just going to listen. I'm going to make you feel like you're involved. And that's the problem is, as you talked about, if there isn't something, if there's a vacuum, it will get filled.
Yeah.
If you're not giving someone a platform to have a voice, they will use that voice somewhere else where you can't hear it.
Yeah.
And a lot of schools, and we have this from with Eversense, our communication platform, where you can get parents to comment or they can create their own posts linked to their child. And lots of schools are worried. But it is, if you give them a voice, if you give them a place where you can listen to them, they're probably going to be constructive. If you do not give them a voice, if you do not do those parental surveys, if you do not ask for their input, they are not going to be saying positive things about you. If you're not listening to them, they can say anything they want because you're not listening. So it is about very much, not only for those teachers, in making sure they know they are being heard and they are part of the change and you're listening and they're included, but it's the same with the parents. We have to make them feel listened to. We have to make them feel they have a voice. It's not just a case of someone going, oh, yeah, I've heard from, and actually this is what we're going to do, which is exactly what the parents want. But if you make them feel that they were part of that,
that's exactly it.
It's a huge difference. It's feeling part of that change, not going, oh, they did that. Well, I've been saying that for years. Because they always say, as soon as you do the thing they want, they're probably saying that for years. They should have listened to me. Well, they did, but not in such a direct route. So if you just give them that voice where that parent can say that, and then you do it, like, they listen to me. I have a voice. I can share. I can contribute. And they're going to change.
And I have agency. And for parents and pupils and staff to feel that they've got agency is a really powerful driver of improvement. You know, similarly, that heads and senior leaders will have their own lived experiences to draw on. So they may have their own biases and their own beliefs that are perpetuated, right? So that idea of you know, like just quick, short surveys, everything we do with the wellbeing quality mark is anonymous. We ensure that everything is anonymous so people can say what they want. And I have to say, and interestingly as well, when the results come in, leaders also intuitively, the first thing they do is they look to the bottom left of the distribution curve, right? And I always have to say to them, why are you looking there? Right? They're your cultural outliers. We're more interested in where the distribution sits on the graph more so. And in the same way, the ones on the bottom right, you know, they're also cultural outliers where everything's rosy in the garden, everything's brilliant. Like, you know, but we expend an awful lot of energy on the bits that don't really matter, you know. And so I think it's really helpful to be doing, there's a lot of people are doing those sort of like weekly spot surveys or whatever, just a quick few questions. They're really, really helpful. You can ask consult too often. And then get the danger of, like, you know, consultation sort of like weariness, you know, fatigue. But actually, you know, what I like to do is build it into the process. And then, as you say, have those informal conversations. Can somebody help me understand? Because by this, I think what you mean is this. Because some people still won't want to say it in a staff meeting forum. And that's fine. We've got to get different ways for people to have their voices heard, you know, and again, really, really important for parents and for pupils, because I don't want to wait until Ofsted put a survey out to the pupils and the staff and the parents to know what they're thinking.
No.
And I want to be in a position to be able to say to them, well, actually, when we did this exercise earlier, so therefore you can see where our scores were here, you know, and this is what we're being told. So clearly, it's all about using your intelligence, using your data intelligently, you know, to inform where you want to go, what you want to do, and to bring everybody on the journey.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. And it is, again, it's always a sense of being listened to. Why is that important? Because it means I matter. And it's all those sorts of things, which again, go right back to our three words, well-being, culture and inclusion. And I think within education, generally, we think the word inclusion generally relates to SEND, and there's a whole thing with United about inclusion. But as soon as you step outside of school, that inclusion is much wider. Everyone is included. And in the new Ofsted framework, they talked about those groups who may not learn, and it's SEND and wider groups. So when we think of that inclusion, that is huge. So we've got to come back to what will shape the well-being, culture and inclusion. Being clear with our expectations, being clear with our values. When you talked about is that in our school values? Are you curating your culture as a school? Are you literally, obviously wanting to demonstrate what your beliefs are, not just hoping they're picked up on? Are you being really clear? And that will lead to better well-being. Because you're really clear on those expectations by including everyone. All these three things are just so entwined; it's unreal.
Yeah. And that's what. So when we do this, we do the questionnaire with the staff, and then we get schools to do a self-evaluation form based on those six areas that Professor Weir outlined, and so they explain how they're addressing those areas, and then we co-construct with leaders. And well, firstly, I go and do an assessment day with them, and I use those as coaching opportunities and as capacity building opportunities for the school. But actually, by the end of it, we co-construct targets that the school want to work on. So it feeds into the school improvement. It can feed into the performance management process for the head teachers if needs be, because there's a robustness behind it. Because what normally happens is an external advisor will come in. It will be based on nothing other than what other schools have decided to do or the latest thing, rather than where the school is. What we try to do is reflect where the school is and where we need to take it next, you know, in order to continue that upward trajectory and that movement. And then the following year, we can come back, repeat the process. They don't need to do the self-evaluation the same way, but we come back and then look at how effectively they've achieved those objectives, you know, and then agree new objectives based on the new surveys that we do. So lots of companies, you know, there's lots of companies who will charge a lot of money just to do a parent survey or a pupil survey. We've built all of that into the process because it's a whole process, because we're influencing the culture, and we're helping people to design it. We're not giving the answers. We're starting the thought process and we're starting the debate, but we will signpost where you might get the answers and what it might look like. What it's important, though, is that leaders use their contextual wisdom of their settings in order to then move it on. Because if it was as simple, if we knew what was going to work, we'd be doing it already. That's the bottom line. It's about using your contextual wisdom to improve based. And again, in some settings, I end up coaching leadership teams, and you know, we offer ongoing support if that's necessary. Again, that tends to happen more in bigger schools or where specialist settings, I've got to say, because smaller schools or primary schools don't have that amount of resource available, quite frankly, you know. But it's about creating alignment and creating that, because that's what we're trying to do: structure, routine, consistency. And we start getting that right, we're going to start influencing the well-being culture and those other things, the well-being, the culture and the inclusive nature of the school.
Definitely. And I'm going to wrap it up there, because that's a great way to end it. And it is, as you just said, we're not going to give you the answer. We're not going to give you a five-step approach of these are the five things you have to do, apart from be reflective, include everyone.
Use research,
make people feel valued. And also, one of the things which you touched on, which is something I really believe at B Squared, is reading, writing, and maths, especially in primary, is the only really outcome that everyone really cares about. But as you said earlier, there is so much more. We have EHCPs, you've got the broad areas of need, what's that? The executive, there's so many things that actually, how are you supporting and celebrating that? How are you making people moving on to the next? There's all that sort of stuff that actually, how are you doing that? Because if that's what a child needs to work on, that's what you should be working on. That's include. So yeah, hopefully we've given you lots of things to think about, lots of kind of, okay, reflective parts for where you are as a school, what you're doing, what your next steps are. So as always, and sometimes just listening to the podcast, it's a great time to just to have that reflection on what it is for you.
And that's making time and space. That is therein. Yeah. This is exactly what we're talking about.
And it is, you're literally, maybe you already know, I know exactly what we need to do. But before you start that, just get that input from others. Because it might be from your experience in your previous setting, and actually I'm in a different setting. Are the team going to be responding in the same way? Are we on board? What do I need to get? So it is not necessarily the diving straight into action. It's spending that more time on that planning and assessing where you are before you get to the doing. So thank you for coming to the show today. As always, Cathal's given me some links, and you'll find them in the show notes. So his website, his book, MVB Framework for Promoting Wellbeing and Responding to Mental Health in School. So they're all in the show notes. And as always, you're going to find them wherever you listen to the podcast or on the Sendcast website. And if you want to get in touch, let us know your thoughts, suggest topics or anything else, please send a message to us via our social media accounts or send an email to hello@thesendcast.com. The Sendcast is created by us here at B Squared. And do you know about our AI features within our assessment software? Teachers can use our AI to help write their reports or summarize progress. Teachers choose the key achievements and the key next steps for each pupil, so it is very personalized. And the AI does take the hard work away, turning what you want to focus on and creating those lovely paragraphs of text for you. And the system can also translate into 40 different languages, helping to engage parents where English is not their first language. Visit the B Squared website or click on the meeting link in the show notes to book a meeting with me to take you through our assessment software and all of its AI features. And as always, thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Sendcast. It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me. Thank you.
Bye, everyone.